Hello and welcome to another podcast of Peter Hill Explains. I'm talking through the 2017 HSC Physics exam. I previously spent two podcasts on the first question, and then the next podcast is getting from questions 2 to question 7, and after 40 minutes of just talking away through it, I'm up to question 8. Now, I'm taking my time to teach as much background physics to develop understanding as much as possible. The idea is that you can listen to this as you go through on your public transport home, and possibly, ideally, you've actually attempted these multiple choice questions before you've listened to the podcast. That's what I'd recommend as an educator. We're up to question 8. An electron is fired in a vacuum towards a screen. So the electron's gone off. I'll read it all the way through. An electron is fired in a vacuum towards a screen. With no electric field being applied, the electron hits the screen at a point called P. A uniform electric field is turned on, and another electron is fired towards the screen from the same location at the same velocity, striking the screen at a point Q. And so we have a screen here with a black asterisk for P, which is in the dead center, and the electron is deviated off to the left about, or if you had a P at zero and the extreme screen going from minus 100 to plus 100, at around minus 75, goes off to the left, and that's point Q. With the electric field still turned on, a proton is fired toward the screen from the same starting point as the electrons, and with the same velocity. So we've got a proton at the same velocity. So what's going to happen is it will take the same time to go from the gun or the thing that's firing to the screen, because it's travelling the same distance and at the same velocity, so it's got the same time. A proton has a different charge, so the electric field here is pointing from left to right, because the electrons go the opposite direction of an arrow pointed on the electric field. Now, the electric field, you'd point with a line, but there'd be a mid arrow in that line there. Now, there are four points. Point A is at minus 90. Point B is at minus 15. Point C is at plus 5, I suppose, and point D is at plus 75 or 70. So that's to the right. So remember that the electric field deviated the electron to minus 75, and so you have to select which of these ones going from the left to the right, and they ask you simply A, B, C, or D. Now, the proton, being of a positive charge, will go in the direction of the applied electric field, in the opposite direction, so it has to be C or D. Now, D is the same deflection as Q, but remember, this is not a gravitational field where the actual effect of gravity is proportional to the mass, so all things, light or small, follow the same trajectory, fall at the same rate. This is more massive, so the force is the same because it's proportional to the charge. The proton is more massive, so your answer is C. Quite a nice question. Question 9. What does the Maltese cross apparatus demonstrate about cathode rays? Now, the Maltese cross apparatus, I'll talk to a bit after this, and it says that the cathode rays, which is electrons, they travelled in straight lines. They consist of a beam of electrons. They are absorbed by a metal surface. They are not affected by magnetic fields. And that's quite interesting. Okay, so the general textbook answer is that they travelled in straight lines because, and of course the textbooks are dreadful in the picture, in the way they depict this, because if light travels in a straight line, it casts a shadow, and with these electrons, they cast this seems a shadow on the glass surface, and we'll have to talk through that. So that's the correct answer. They consist of a beam of electrons. Well, this apparatus does not actually prove that they're electrons. They might be something. This is the understanding of history. They are absorbed by a metal surface. This is actually quite an interesting one. I suppose absorb, they actually go onto a metal surface. This is true. This is why the electrons don't travel any further forward. I'd like that one. They are not affected by magnetic fields. Well, indeed, with the Maltese cross, you can introduce a magnetic field and go across. Now, this is, why does it look like light? Why does it produce light? Start off. The electrons emerge. So the Maltese cross is a vacuum tube, and it was actually built by the Germans because the British couldn't produce it at the time. And so what used to happen is they'd get a tube and they'd attach it to a vacuum pump, or used to fill it up with mercury and let the mercury drain away, leaving a vacuum behind. And so what they would do is that build it as a sort of a tear-shaped object, and with electrical feed-throughs. So there's a point where there's a disc plate, which they develop for discharge tubes. So this would create a uniform field of electrons coming from this negative plate, you'd have a certain gas which would glow. So this is the electrode, which is generally an aluminium or brass button. I think it's aluminium that most people prefer. Further into the tube, so the tube looks a bit like a TV set. You have the metal cross, which can go up and down. Now, the Germans, when they first didn't actually make a Maltese cross. They made the German national flag cross, and so I suppose the British reporting it called it a Maltese cross rather than referring to a German national symbol. And there'd be nothing after this. It'd be just the glass tube. Now, the question is, how would this fluoresce? Well, glass itself, sodium, has a lot of sodium in it and a lot of defects. It's a disordered, glassy subject. So when it hits with electrons, it produces light. So the glass itself would fluoresce. And you'll often see in these old tubes that the glass will become, I suppose, tired. I think I've forgotten the actual technical term for it, saturated or burnt. So the fluorescence will drop. Fluorescence efficiency will drop over time. So sometimes when you actually put the Maltese cross down, the area that was shadow will glow more brightly. I've really forgotten the term for these effects. You could actually regenerate your luminous efficiency of your your Maltese cross apparatus by heating up the glass. Re-annealing it. I just really, it's gone from my mind at the moment. I've had this operation where my memory is hard to get back. Now, I suppose the really interesting thing is that the Maltese cross requires, for the apparatus to actually work, a small atmosphere which discharges. So this is a very weak atmosphere. It's not a vacuum, and this forms a positive column, which, due to the shape of the actual glass, comes up from the positive electrode, which is positioned in the glass tube, which goes down to the stand. And this, you can see this if you turn off the light, as a blue glowing gas, and this blue glowing gas goes up and creates a finger of light of gas just in front of the negative electrode. And this finger of gas, this needle point of gas, actually creates an intense electric field just at the center of this button. So the actual electrons don't emerge uniformly from this electrode. Actually emerges from the very center, and if you actually look at this electrode, you'll see a little dark region in the center where the electrons have emerged from. And so for the Maltese cross to actually work, high vacuum, it doesn't work. You'd require too high a field. So by introducing very, very low pressure gas, this gas forms a column, and this column, from the shaping of the tube, goes and only creates charge, or there's a charge column. So your electric field is a very intense at this point. So it's sort of like an accidental electron gun. So this electron gun is basically a point source of light, which does illuminate the cross. And so if electrons, as they were in the textbook, all travelled away from the surface parallel, you'd get some penumbra. They have the idea that electrons would, all travel uniformly parallel. You'd get some sort of penumbra, and you'd get no magnification. Because it's a point source, imagine it's sort of like you standing in front of a campfire. Your shadow is much bigger on the trees behind you. And this is true for the Maltese cross, indicating that the electrons come from one point. You can see when the cross is up, the metal cross is up. So the metal cross is on this hinge, so you can hinge it upwards or hinge it downwards. So move it out of the way, or move it in without breaking the vacuum system. And you can see that when the cross is up, electrons actually bounce off the surface. And so in order to get this work, you normally get a high voltage self-induction device to provide high voltage to it. Lots of fun getting that to get that to spark. And so you can see electrons bounce off that, and you can also see some electrons travel off around the electrode into the electrode area. So there's a lot to observe here, and a lot they read the textbook and they see the experiment and they know the exam and they just move on. But there's actually quite a lot to look at the Maltese cross there, and a lot of history there. Question 10. On to the next question. The diagram shows a model of a generator connected to a galvanometer. And so the generator is this classic group of wires around an axis, and it's rotating in a core. So it's rotating around the axis, the wires are rotating, or a single wire is rotating around the axis, to make it easy to understand. And it goes to a split ring commutator. And quite correctly, the split ring commutator has its gaps on the top and bottom positions, because at that position the wire is traveling in the direction of the magnetic field, therefore there's no induced current in current there. I'll have to explain it a bit more, but the commutator acts as a switch, and I show a galvanometer there, and rather nice to the students here. They haven't put a little circle with a G there. They've got actually a galvanometer with an arrow on it, it says the loop is rotated in a clockwise direction as viewed from the end nearest the galvanometer. Rich wrote the table correctly identifies the type of generator and the movement of the needle of the galvanometer. So you have types of generators DC and AC. Now this is a DC generator because it's got a commutator. And so it's two DC generators. And it says the needle, so it's between A and C, which are both DC. The needle swings between 0 and plus. For A, the needle swings between plus and minus. Now to be DC, it's got to be between 0 and plus. Now you could work out the direction that's moving, how the actual electromotive force operates in the actual conductor, and the way that you would do that. So that's the answer to that question. It's a DC generator swinging between 0 and plus. Now the way that you'd work out the electromotive force is to consider the wire with positive charges, and you look at the wire to the right here. You'd let the positive charges sit in the wire, and the wire is actually moving, so that's a current, an effective current. You point your magnetic field lines from the north to the south pole, and so the electric field lines, if you had, would be your fingers with your palm on the north side, and your fingers stretched away to the to the south, the current therefore would be down. I have to actually work this out. A twist there, it's actually pushing the positive charge towards the positive electrodes there, and it's indeed, it would swing from positive to negative in that diagram. Moving on, we're at 18 minutes, and I'll try and make this half an hour for you guys. We're moving on to question 11. Okay, we have an AC generator going through some coils, and it is the classic symbol for a for a transformer. So there's two lines down indicating a magnetic core flux, magnetic coupling or laminated plates, and on the right side, so on the left side, there's about 8 coils. And on the right side, there's 4 coils, and this goes across to the right side to create a plate which is 0.1 meters apart. And So you've got the AC source. So this is a step-down transformer because you've got more coils. It's there's a volt per. If quite easy to say, look, there's a volt per coil. So it's roughly 10 volts to 4 volts down. An AC source is connected to a transformer having a primary winding of 900 turns. It's connected to a secondary turning winding of 450 turns. So it's a step down. There'll be greater current and smaller volts. Is connected to a pair of parallel plates 0.01 meters apart. The AC input is shown in the graph, and it goes from plus 340 volts to minus 340 volts. So the field strength is going to be half that, so it will go from 170 volts to minus 170 volts. Now the field strength is the volts per meter there. So 70 is it's you multiply 170 by 100, so the field strength is V on D, or the voltage is E times D, the electric field by the distance the distance travelled. So the maximum field strength in volts per meter, it's a fairly simple thing, so it's 170 divided by 1/100, and so the answer is A, 1.7, B, 6.8, which I think would be the opposite, multiplying. If you got the step up, step down incorrect, I would expect that's about 4 times difference, that's right. C, 1.7 by 10 to the 4, or 6.8 by 10 to the 4, so the answer is 1.7 by 10 to the 4. So I suppose that tests your understanding of SI units. Question number 12, here we're going here. A satellite orbits the Earth in an elliptical orbit. So it's a bit like an egg with X on the left much closer and Y on the right. It's rather nice that they've got a picture of Australia. Australia there. And it looks a fairly good picture of the Earth. It looks a bit, probably a bit strange, I don't know, in terms of the actual radius, the amount of Earth that you can see. Okay, which row of the table correctly identifies the position at which the satellite has greater kinetic energy and the position which it has greater potential energy? So, what's happening is that it's got the greatest potential energy at infinity, and the way that potential energy is minus big G, gravitational constant, M, the mass of your planet, M, the mass of the satellite, divided by R. That's minus, so it's at its greatest at infinity. So the greatest potential energy is Y, and if it's travelling around, it's obviously speeds at X. So the two options you're given is greater kinetic energy, greater potential energy. Answer A is A, X and X. B is X and Y, which is the correct one. C is Y and X, and D is Y and Y. Fairly straightforward question. Again, hopefully you've done this before. Going up to 24 minutes here. Just going to do me in doing this. So what they have here, again, I can sort of see why they do this here. A triangular piece of wire is placed in a magnetic field as shown. And you have a rotation axis XW going up there. Oh yes, okay. So XW is one axis, and YZ is another axis where things where the arrows go, and you've got magnetic field lines travelling from left to right. And to make it clear, now I'll pay that they put the arrows at the end of those magnetic field lines, and it's, I suppose, you know, what I'd prefer is that they put little dashes at the end to indicate the magnetic field lines are just not beginning artificially in space. And so you've got the current travelling around, and it says when the current is applied, which way does the wire move? Now, at the bottom end of the triangle is travelling with the magnetic field line, so therefore it's got no force. And you take the right side of the triangle, the current is moving upwards from the base of the triangle up to the apex, which is on the axis WX. Now, what you would do here is with your right hand slap rule, you'd place your thumb along the direction of the current, your fingers along the direction of the magnetic field lines. That's like holding it out as you've got your hand down, and so that would push into the page on the right side. We'll just go through here. You've got four things: axes of rotation, YZ, which is rotation with the field lines, or WX, rotation perpendicular to the field line. So the rotation is definitely perpendicular. And it says the point R on the... So you've got A and B. That's with the axis is with the field lines. CD is axis parallel, sorry, perpendicular to the field lines. So it's C or D. And as I've pointed out before, looking at that axis, you have the point at the bottom of the triangle, the right hand side, being pushed into the page. So it's the answer is number C, WX. And R into the page. I'm sorry, I haven't actually described that one too well for you. Oh, there's a bowerbird which just flew past me. So what we have here is number 14 is a picture of a load. You have a DC circuit, and it's going. There's one circle. So you have a transformer with an input and an output coil, and a resistor on both. On the input coil, there is a circuit of a resistor with a power supply and a switch, and you're monitoring the voltage on the resistor. So that's on the primary coil. On the secondary coil, you're looking at the resistor and the voltage across it. And it says in the diagram shows a DC circuit containing a transformer. I wish I probably read that easier to tell you. The potential differences V1 and V2 are measured continuously for 4 seconds. The switch is initially closed. So initially there is current flowing. At time t equals 2 seconds, the switch is opened. So the switch drops off all of a sudden. I suppose you've got the transformer being... Okay, let's read it. Which of the pair of graphs shows how the potentials V1 and V2 vary at time over a 4 second interval? This, I suppose, is not too exciting. The important thing to remember is that the Faraday's law for induction and a transformer is an inductively coupled circuit, is that the EMF created is minus the rate of flux, the change of rate of flux per unit time. So your output circuit is the differential of the current of your input circuit. Now, if it's sinusoidal, the difference of a sine is a cosine, so there's no, you know, the current just appears to go through, there's just a phase shift as it goes through, because a differential here. And so you're looking down here for a differential signal. You're looking at the start that V1 is open and then closed, and at T2 it's open, so it's closed, and then when it's open the voltage stops because there's no current across the resistor. V equals IR, as I think I've described before. So the answer, we've got several options here, but there's only one where the voltage, there's two where the voltage starts at V1 and then drops to zero. That's when the switch is closed. And then of those two, one shows a spike or a differential increase. The rate of change of flux per time is massive at the time when the circuit is open, and it shows a spark, and so that's a spike up, and that's A, whereas B shows a rising and falling DC created. We're coming along here. I'll keep going for 40 minutes. How about that? Okay, we're up to question 15. And this shows a car with an accelerometer in it. And it shows an intersection. And you're traveling from left to right into this a roundabout. So you're in your car, and you are traveling in a straight line, and you start to accelerate to your left. You're traveling left, left to right, and you start centripetal acceleration. That is, you're traveling from left to right, and so you accelerate as far as the page is concerned upwards, and once you're on your orientation of your car has changed, you now follow the intersection around, and at that point you'd be accelerating in to the center of the intersection. As far as the car is concerned, you'd be accelerating to what's described here in the diagram as X. An accelerometer that measures the acceleration along the direction X prime, that is along the axis of your wheels, or as far as you're driving between your left and right hands, is fixed in the car. The graph shows the measurement record of the accelerometer over a 20-second interval. What happens here is that you would get a brief acceleration towards the left, and then a uniform acceleration to the right for a period of time, and then again acceleration to the left to pull off there. I think the intersection, also the roundabout, makes it more confusing. You really need to just draw circles here. And the answer here is B. I won't go into describing it, but it shows a strong negative centripetal acceleration, center pulling acceleration, followed by a uniform time of positive centripetal acceleration as you go around the main arc, and then a small pulse of negative acceleration as you go off it again. An AC supply is connected to a light bulb. This is question 16. An AC supply is connected to a light bulb by two long parallel conductors as shown. Which graph shows the variation in time of the magnetic force between the two conductors? This is Ampere's experiment. So if you have two conductors and you put current through the two conductors, the top and bottom conductors, the two parallel conductors, the bottom one, just to make it simple, will produce a magnetic field. Now, you can use the right-hand wrap rule. Your thumb goes along the direction of the current. Your fingers is the wrapping magnetic field. And so if you can imagine, the magnetic field is actually hitting the top current, the top plate, with your fingers pointed towards your face. And if the current's going through in the same direction, your thumb is pointing that current, use your right hand slap rule again, and this says that the actual force is pushing the top plate down. And indeed, if you've dealt with high powered lasers or high currents that I have, you'll know that the actual power lines, if the currents are travelling the same direction, will push together, and if they're travelling in opposite directions, they'll push apart. Essentially here, they say what essentially happens with the AC power supply. The current is going high and then low, it's initially travelling towards the light globe in the top, in the first part of the cycle on the top wire, and away from the light globe in that same cycle. And so you'll always get a repulsive force, but it will be episodic. So at a point in the cycle where there's no current, because it's a sinusoidal current going from high to low, or high through zero to low, to the negative value, you'll get a episodic repulsion, which is answer number D, the actual currents is pulsing away. 37, let's see how we're going, up to question 17, I'm getting faster. Okay, oh no, this is a prac which I actually get students to do, because it's actually quite an easy and interesting one to do. What you do is you have a magnet mounted on a balance, although this is a little bit confused here, the idea, so this is a horseshoe magnet, and the horseshoe is sitting quite neatly on the balance, upside down, and you have a single conductor going from left, going through it, and using the right-hand slap rule, you would get a force on the magnet as well as on the wire. Now, I suppose the interesting thing is that the force on the wire is easy to understand, but the magnet has to have an equal and opposing force on it. So although there's a force on the wire, it means the force on the magnet is opposite to it. So you just can't get a force generated if you get a force. So there'll be a magnetic force. You've got a current going through a wire, and the wire is actually going through a magnetic field. Okay, a magnet rests on an electronic balance. A rigid copper rod runs horizontally through the magnet at right angles to the magnetic field. The rod is anchored so it cannot move. Which expression can be used to calculate the balance reading when the switch is closed? So this is interesting. I think this is quite a brilliant question, because you'd have to actually think through that you're not measuring the force on the clamp, you're measuring the force of the magnet going up. So it starts off that you have a reading on the scales of 0.2 kilograms, and the magnetic field is going from south to north in the page. It's hard to orient it, but imagine that your fingers on your right hand is pointing away from you, and the current is going from positive to negative, that your thumb is pointing away to you. So what happens is that your fingers, I'd say, pointing away for you, and your just hold your hand out, and your fingers are the magnetic field lines going from the positive side, going from the north to the south, and your current is going to the right, is going away from you in this page. It's a three-dimensional page. It's very difficult to describe. And so when this is switched on, it's going to push the wire up, but in pushing the wire up, it's going to push the magnet down. So there'll be a force on the magnet downwards. So the actual force on the actual scales will increase. So you've got four options here. Now, the force on the magnet is it's very, very hard to read here, because they haven't actually explained what the I and the L corresponds to. But it says you've got options A, 0.2 kilograms plus BL, BIL, very difficult for me to read without glasses. B, the force of the magnet in kilograms, times BLI divided by 9.8, and so that's plus, so B will be the correct answer. So BLI, because it doesn't read in newtons, it reads in kilograms calibrated to the Earth's surface, that will be correct. BLI on 9.8. Now, one of the things that you can, the trap here is 0.2 kilograms minus BL, so this is wrong doubly, and because it pushes the rod up, it's actually pushing the magnet down. So it's pushing by actually lifting the rod up, it's actually pushing itself down. And finally, D, the incorrect sign, but 9.8, which actually converts a force in newtons to kilograms. Here we are at 43 minutes, and I'll continue my next podcast at question 18 and beyond. Bye. Thanks for listening as I've tried to read myself through this.